2/10 perfectly vertical for a halfway run. Or I could, you know, an 80-meter inverted V or S. If I did 40, I would just go up 35 feet up the tree. If I was doing 20 meters, same thing, 25, 30 feet up the tree. But I'm leaning because I, you know, all my antennas, I'm sure you remember, are in my attic, and I have a lot of noise on 40 meters. And I do DX on my 40-meter dipole. My 20-meter dipole, I do very good DXing, but no DXing on my 80-meter dipole, and it's even harder to get outside the first, second, and third call district. So, but then I was thinking, you know, DXing on 80 meters isn't as easy as it is on 20 and 40 meters. You know, having a low-angle takeoff antenna is great, but, you know, 80 meters begins to take on properties of medium wave, and it's just a lot of different, it's just a different animal altogether. Well, and then 160 meters is a completely different beast. But I don't know. I have the ability to put up an outside antenna, and I'm just undecided as to what I can do. And I got that big that I can get really high up, so I figured why not take advantage of all the height. That's why I threw that out there, like, which would you pick? So that's about it there.
Okay. Well, yeah, the trouble is it's really apples and oranges, because when you shift the orientation 90 degrees, it changes a lot of things. Vertical radiating antennas are more forgiving for being placed towards the ground. You don't have quite the problems that you do with horizontals. With a horizontal radiating antenna, you really should get it at least a half of a wavelength above the ground. Otherwise, as I mentioned, you'll have the reflection that causes it to be more of a very localized near vertical incident sky wave. And also a lot of the energy is lost in coupling to the ground. In the vertical polarization angle, if you raise it up sufficiently so that you don't have too much ground coupling, you don't have to be that concerned of getting it as far up as you do a horizontal. If you plant the vertical smack dab onto the ground, you need some degree of radials to shield your ground loss. But in the case of a half wave, you don't have to be concerned too much with counterpoising and such. So you can hang it lower if you want it, if it's vertically oriented, than if it's the V, inverted V. Personally, again, I would probably go with the inverted V because I know exactly how the orientation is going to work for me. And also, there's a lot to be said for a common mode antenna that spares you a lot of headache with common mode getting back into your shack, and RF can really mess up a shack these days.
It's very good. You know what's going to happen? It's going to come down to me flipping a coin. And first, I got to find that climbing tree stand. All right, thanks a lot, Roy, for the input. This is KD2RMD.
You're welcome, Russell. And wire is relatively cheap, so you might decide to do both.
You know, it's funny.
Unfortunately, you're popping out of the repeater, so I barely heard that last communication. You might be over deviating the repeater, so on pops, it just goes out of the reception band, so you might want to pull the microphone a couple inches farther away from your mouth and try that again.
All right, Roger Roy, I was just saying, I completely overlooked that. Just go with both. So, all right, back to net control. Thanks.
You're welcome, Russell, and, you know, that's the benefit of most of these designs that we've been talking about. The wire is relatively cheap, so please consider it, and either way, when you figure out how it worked out for you, come back and report to the rest of us, so we'll learn something from it.
All right, thank you. KD2RMD.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Russell. Once again, this is AC2GS, and my name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. If you have any questions of a technical nature or topics you would like to have discussed, or if you want to discuss the COVID-19 situation as best I can, we can do that as well. So anything you want to discuss, we're here to discuss it with you. Just give us your first name and your call sign.
Into RVP.
Yes, RVP.
Good evening, this is Matt. How you doing? I was listening to your QSO. I just took a walk. Let me catch my breath. I was just taking a walk around the hood, and I carried my HC. I'm trying to get in. I'm on the Eastern repeater. Maybe the guys are keying up too fast. I heard you talking about antennas. W2NDR. He goes to the flea market. It's one of my ham friends. He's with Lockfield. He helped me put up a dipole. I have a 133-foot dipole, and it's really not. It works out really on 80 meters most of the time because I'm on a net. So, I noticed the other day, you know, we put a rope in because it started that way. I noticed it was coming. It was like it was the one leg that comes off the mast from my roof. It was really getting low. And I looked out the window. Maybe one, because when you put it up, you have to remember you're going through this brush in my wood. So maybe a branch broke. There was holes in it. And the center, you know, where the insulator was, you know, with the 67, you know, it was on top of the shed, and it ended up got more slack. So I had to roll. I'm not going to go up on the roof. I can't do that. So I just rolled up some copper wire and put a tire up to get rid of the slack. But I'm going to put up an R7. He's going to give me an R7 antenna vertical. I also want to make an N-fit as a backup. And I might get one of let me give it back to you for your comment.
Well, all those are great designs. It's possible that the way you fastened it came loose. It's also possible, depending upon the rope, you have to be very cautious with the types of rope that you use. Some of them are kind of designed with a little too much stretch. So if it's holding up something a little on the heavy side over time, it'll just get stretchier and stretchier and stretchier. So you have to find that happy medium. You don't want something that's brittle and will snap. You want something that has a little bit of give, but you don't want it to have a little too much give.
I actually have a 20. It was up for 10 years until Hurricane Sandy took down the tree, and I moved. The problem is, I have the RG, I think 8 is the heaviest stuff. I got RG58. Got the connector here. I've been trying to get the connector back, but it fell off, and I want to fix it, you know. But it works, you know, but it's not bad. But what I want to do is I like playing around with antennas. I got my extra clients and how they work. You know, you got the angle. That's where you do the calculations. But I got this balance on the one. But what I'm going to do with it is Charlie, KD2GAIN8, told me, I don't like heights. I don't want people depending on other people to help me. I appreciate it. But if I'm in a bind, I want to depend on myself. So I might invest my money in a spider beam. It's basically a collapsible nylon pole. And it opens up to 40 feet. So I'm thinking to get that and either clamp it to my fence post, just put it near a tree, and maybe get bungee cords or something, and put the other end of the end fed on that. If something happens, at least I could pull it down and I could fix it and have to climb it or we'll have to shot. So I want to put that up. That's a summer project. And then me an antenna. It's vertical. I'm thinking I'll put it on a mast and tie it to a fence post in the corner of my yard. Actually, what I could do, if I could fix the coax on this 20-meter dipole, connect it, and use the existing coax then, run it right to that antenna. What do you think? Back to you, N2RBP.
KC2FYJ with a comment.
You just have to figure out which is the most structurally secure means and the most cost-effective. The spider beam pole, that kind of strikes me as a kind of great temporary thing. You want something lightweight that you can carry around and set up and then knock down when you're done with it. It would be great for things like field day. You might want to look into something a little bit more permanent. They sell aluminum tubing and such, and they're usually different sizes. They slide into each other, and you can fasten them tightly. And that's probably going to end up in the long term more sturdy for you.
KC2FYJ with comment.
Yes, Harry.
A few moments back, you were talking about line that stretched. Typically, you'll find that the stretchy line is actually made out of polypropylene. And it occurs to me that for line for outdoor use, that it might be ideal to find line from a marine store, because the line that's made for boats is very definitely intended to handle the weather.
Okay, that's a good idea. I happened upon a company, Italian company called Mistrant. I believe DX Engineering sells all their stuff. And their rope has worked for me, but marine rope might be something to look into. Certainly, I'm sure all of their stuff is UV protected as well.
But not the polypropylene. That stuff is not UV protected, and it does stretch, and it stretches a lot before it will ultimately break.
Yeah, I agree with you, Harry. All rope was not created equal. The proper tool for the proper job, as they say.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I've been getting these 75-foot lengths from Harbor Freight. If he's got a Harbor Freight near him, it's a Dacron rope, 3/8 in diameter. And it's like, I don't know, it's cheap. It's like $8 or something. For like 75 feet, and it won't stretch. I mean, I've been using it for years now. And I find out that, you know, I eventually change out a lot of the old ropes I had. Some of them get really worn out rubbing against the trees. If you don't have a pulley involved, and this stuff is durable. You know, it just doesn't wear out. I got some of them go over a branch, and it's a Dacron type. If you look at it, it's like black and red, you know, black and red look to it when you buy it. It comes in a plastic bag. Harbor Freight's pretty good for some stuff like that. Back to you, Roy.
Well, thanks for that suggestion, Paul. I find Harbor Freight, you gotta know someone who tried it out before you. You don't want to experiment. Some of their stuff is very effective and inexpensive, and other things that they sell are not terribly high quality.
Oh, I agree. A lot of the hand tools are good, you know, axes and shovels, you know, things like, they're very, very good. But if I got to plug it in, I have to think about it before I buy it from there. But the rope is good. It's very, very good. I had no problems with it. If I saw one rope wearing out, I would change it out and do that. You know, I have dipoles. I'm dipole happy. So now I have two of them up, so that's four ropes. So you can't beat it. And then I come down, I'll tie it off. I'll even get a cleat, you know, these cleats that you could either get in a marine store or even Home Depot, you know, to tie them off. So, you know, I don't even cut the ropes. I just, you know, loop them around, and I could lower it and bring it up anytime I want. You know, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good, Paul. Yeah, I mean, people have all kinds of intriguing gadgets that they use with their ropes. I've used a pulley system on one of my rope secured sand dipoles that have worked reasonably well for me. I was a little concerned that it might jump off the pulley, but thankfully it hasn't. There are all kinds of wonderful little schemes people use because of that problem, that you don't want something that has absolutely positively no stretch whatsoever, especially when it's tied to something like a tree that moves in the wind. So you have to find some happy medium. But, Dacron polyester, I think, is a very common material that ropes are made of. So, Matt, I hope you learned something from this conversation with the other guys.
Okay, you know, one, I was talking to Tom, you know, from the one with the Great South Bay. A lot of times you want to put like a wheat and it sways with the trees. I think it's great to put on trees. The problem I have with my prop, I have an acre. So if the leaves come off the trees and it's in the fall, it's great. But it's got a lot of brush between the trees. So if your antenna comes down like now, like, I mean, if you get price, I've had somebody come in and clear all the brush and all these other small trees, yeah, you get all this space. Like, when I take a walk around my neighborhood, if I was going to redo the antenna, I got some tall trees in the front yard, and there's no brush. What you could do is you could run the dipole from one of these, you know, get a slingshot, throw a rope in it, and then run it over the house, and then have the center, if you on the roof, have the center of it, like right where the mass is for the 2 meter 440 antenna, and have the other end, there's trees along the perimeter before you go way into the woods. You can run it into one of those trees, but it's working. Fall comes and the leaves come off the tree. Maybe some guys can work to take a look at it. But I'm going to definitely have that pole. See what I've done one time when I put three. If I don't want to use like a slingshot, I could even take the spider beam and use it just to get the wire in the crop of the tree. You know, you do it. You know, I could get. But maybe I can get another rope in the same tree. And, you know, I know a guy that's done trimming my tree. The guy could go up there and put a pulley up for me. You know, I could have him do that. But maybe I'll just do it that way, you know. But that's the project for the summer. I have to get some wire. I'm probably going to get 100 feet of wire. And I'm going to feed it. I get a random wire now, but depending on what band I want, you get the RF. I mean, it's better. I could use this one. Use the same one. It's just, I don't know where it's in. It's just easy to, the wire isn't expensive. I can go to Home Depot, I get 10 gauge wire that's, you know, it's got insulation on it. Maybe we can get it in red and you can see it. And then, boom, run it to the, and then I have a glass. I don't know if you need the counterboards, but I can have this down by the bottom of my shaft and round it, and I'm all set.
Yeah, Matt, there's all kinds of different ways of dealing with it. I would suggest that you think in terms of the things that are easier for you to maintain. So, you know, when you're thinking of a new location, you know, try and put it up someplace where branches won't obstruct your view and limit your ability to deal with it, although trees will grow, and so what was the tip of a tree will eventually be the middle of the tree. But I would suggest you look into, rollers and these nice little pulley systems. Don't buy the cheapest one that you find. They do make very cheap pulley systems. As Harry mentioned, I buy pulleys that are designed for maritime use. So they're nice and sturdy. They're a little bit overpriced, but you pay for quality. So consider those too.
Roger, I got a marine store by my house and stuff there. You know, I just don't if I can get somebody and put a pulley in. But maybe if I put this in. Well, maybe I could just, like, you were talking about poles. Maybe I could put a pole up against the tree, you know, like out of metal. I'll see what happens, but he'll help me. You know, he belongs to Great South Bay, you know, I belong to this club. A lot of guys will help you come put antennas up. But W20 is very helpful, and he's really good at this because he's going up on roofs of houses. I have an attic, actually, but my attic has got my, this house is, it's a true family. I live in this industrial apartment. I'm the owner of the house. So when they built this house, they put the furnace in the attic. I have access to the attic. I'd pull in the attic if I wanted to. But I know what. But all the, you got the, you know, you got the again, you got the furnace up there, and you got a lot of stuff up in there that might interfere with it. But if I ever lived in a condo, I would definitely maybe hire an antenna that way.
Yeah, I mean, there's more than a few fellow club members who have their antennas up in their attic, and they find it very successful. Always I suggest that if you ever have a choice between the antenna being outside or inside, I would pick outside just about every time. But any port in the storm. So if that's the only place some people have space for it, not everyone has a backyard or a lot of empty space or has the ability to run wires from the front to the back of the house or such, then the attic is an interesting solution to that problem. And I sort of wish we had some kind of organization where the younger and spryer members among us who like to climb ladders kind of helped out the old codgers that don't really want to go climbing and, help each other. Because, I mean, that's one of the great things about this hobby. It's not only technical questions that people help, but, fixing things or putting things back together or telling them how it should be put together or coming by and climbing up on a person's roof. So it's sort of a shame that we don't quite have that that facility kind of baked into the club. At one point or another, I believe that there was going to be a committee for that, but I don't know what happened to that.
Comment?
Yes, comment.
This is KD2RMD. Just wanted to say, don't forget all of my dipoles. Okay, I got five antennas up there, and my 20-40-meter dipoles in the attic has given me 45 countries confirmed and 45 states confirmed. So if I'm a big fan of the attic antennas, they work excellent for me. Back to net.
Very good, Russell. Yeah, I was thinking of you, and I was thinking of a few other people that frequent this technical net that have antennas in their attic as well. If it works for you, that's wonderful. That's great. There are guys out there that just string wire in their shack on the wall, and it works for them. I would hate to get a field strength meter and figure out how much RF is running through them and bouncing off of them. But any port in the storm.
2RB for comment.
Yes, Matt.
Okay, K21. When I first got my upgrade to X Plus, we're in 2020. So that must have been about 26 years ago. He came to my house. I was married to the XXYL, I'm making a joke. And he came to my house. I bought a Yaesu FT840. I still have the same tuner I use for each up, 949E tuner. I bought the radio, bought the tuner, bought everything. He came to my house. I made a folded dipole. I used speaker wire. We ran it. We tacked it up on the wall. We must have ran it for the whole apartment. And then we ran it down into the tomb. Earlier, I was doing CW because I wasn't able to accept phone. I have a card like right here. Let me see if my collection here. So I work all day. I just have to get about 15 more. Give me a sec here. Give me a sec here. Okay. I have a card, KA7W2H. I worked this guy, this was just after I got my antenna put up by Norm. I worked this guy on CW June 12, 1994. This guy was in, he was in Idaho, which is like, west. He gave me a 4-2 ST report, but he got me and I got him. But it worked. Back to net.
Yes, indeed. Sometimes it works. It sort of depends upon a bunch of different factors, and mostly probably propagation. And also, interestingly enough, it somewhat has a effect what kind of plastering your house is done. Mine was plastered in the late 1950s when they were still using chicken wire. That was before plaster boards became popular. So my shack is basically a Faraday cage. So if I tried to tack up wires against the wall, probably no one would hear me. But there are other people with other types of plaster work where that's not a problem. So I'm glad that it worked for you. You know, there's all kinds of great stories of antennas that really shouldn't have worked but did. I keep telling the story of a guy who later went on to design and sell antennas. He took a 100-watt light bulb, stuck it on a fence post, and worked all states with it. And there was another gentleman that Dick used to talk about. His antenna supposedly was a piece of wire that was sitting on the ground. Now, most people would tell you that that shouldn't do anything. It should all couple to the ground and be completely inefficient. And yet, he had great action with that antenna. So, you know, if it works for you, dang the theory.
KD2NVB with a comment.
Yes, RNVB.
Yes, Roy, this is Bob, KD2NVB. Yeah, I guess you'll probably recall your light bulb story ring in my mind when I think it's June issue of QST, where they had a light bulb antenna contest, or maybe just a bunch of guys doing it. I think it was a contest. You probably know what I'm talking about. I believe it's the June issue. It's one of the very recent, but not the most recent. No, maybe the May issue. It has a picture on the cover about it. Anyway, back to Ned.
Yeah, it's not apocryphal. I remember the article. They went into the impedance matching of a light bulb. The guy who did the original article didn't really go into any kind of technical discussion. He just showed a picture of a light bulb on a lamppost. But I remember that article from QST. You know, it's really not apocryphal. I have a couple of fellow club members of Kings County Radio Club. I can have a conversation with them on 10 meters with us running our power into our dummy loads instead of actually a radiating antenna. So sometimes things will give out enough RF to suffice. So, you know, that's just the nature of RF.
JD2MVP. Very good, Roy. Yeah, it's the May issue. On the cover, it says the feature article, The Light Bulb QSO Party. I read it. It was interesting and entertaining.
Inform me for a question.
Yes, what's your question?
I'm not Dick. God, God damn. Oh, my God. I'm saying Dick. Question is, like, I thought it would be great to have a antenna in this attic. I mean, I have to cross the beams, but, like, maybe, like I'm going to have a guy help me run wire for my, you know, network, more wire. But say I got into the attic, and I went up there. At the end of the attic, there is the furnace to heat it for my... Because it's gas-fired, what concerns me, you got a wire up there. Say you put a dipole, and you run it across the attic. Do you have to worry about RF dealing with a spark? That can, you know, you get a little gas that comes out a little bit when the thing fires up in the winter. Do you have to worry about, like, with RF and that, where it can cause a spark and boom?
Okay, that's an interesting question. I sort of heard of a different twist on that. Which is whether people should get away with using, you know, the people who need a ground and they can't just kind of knock some copper rod into the ground, but they have to go through some circuitous route, and inevitably they end up connecting their RF ground to their utility power, which is a no-no, and you tell them to connect it to a cold water pipe, assuming that the cold water pipes are all conducting electricity, and they turn around and they say, I don't have a cold water pipe, what about a hot water pipe? And then you're concerned that if you hook up a ground to a hot water pipe and a lightning strike hits and then goes into your boiler, whether that's a fire hazard. I would generally assume, and I'd like to hear other people's opinion on the subject, that there should really a reasonably well-run gas heater should not vent enough volatile gases to endanger your attic. You might have problems with fire inspection in that, you know, if it obstructs the path of firefighters, your insurance company might not be happy with you. But I would tend to think that the risks aren't really that great. I mean, again, love to hear from anyone who has differing opinion or experiences.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, you would smell it if it's a leak, if he's got natural gas. So, you know, that has that smell. Rotten egg smell, so, you know, you're going to have a tight system on a daily basis. I mean, if that was the case, you know, just turning on a light switch would create, you know, might create a spark, although, you know, the old-fashioned light switches, the mercury ones might not, but you know, somebody goes up there with a workman is going to go up there and he lights a torch because he's going to take something apart or whatever he's going to do. I mean, the whole thing would theoretically blow up. You know, you wouldn't be able to light a match. I don't think anybody smokes anymore, but you wouldn't be able to light a match or flick a lighter. Or, you know, if you're going to light a torch, use these strikers and they create sparks. You know, you'd be reading about these things blowing up across the country. I would say that's not possible. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Paul. Yeah, I would sort of agree with you. I would not suggest that you position the antenna with the edge opposite the feed line to be very close to the gas heater, because depending upon the visual of your antenna, it causes the voltage at the edge to be very high, and the boiler is probably grounded, so you might kind of cause some kind of problem there. But I mean, obviously, you just need to keep that in mind when you plan out where to put the antenna, so that it's not right up against the boiler.
WA2BIU with the comment.
Yes, BIU.
Hi, I'm joining the net. The issue of RF ground is not a simple issue at all, because if you're on an upper floor of your house and you drive a stake outside in the ground, the length of your ground wire could be, a fraction of a wavelength, a significant fraction, and therefore when you are nulling the end of it in the ground, but the part near your rig may be at a very high phase of the wave. So the zero point of the wave can be 10 meters away from you or something, and the crest of the wave might be in your shack. So it's not so simple that a ground rod is always good for RF ground.
Well, I agree with you, and in most examples that I use this, it's the guys in the basement or the first floor. So they're talking about 3 feet, but there is always a problem when you're running a relatively long length of ground wire. You want to use something like straps where the impedance is a little bit less, but you still can have problems with longer lengths of ground line. Matter of fact, there are some people who let their ground float because they don't trust a very long ground line. So in principle, I agree with you. I was just really thinking in terms of people, you know, the average ham runs his shack either in his basement or the first floor of his house.
Yeah, that's true. I thought it was a lot of people, but if you're upstairs and you want to set it up there, it can be a problem. And it's not really that many good choices for ground when you're upstairs at all. I don't think the water pipes would be much better for you. That whatever you do is going to have a problem.
Yeah, I agree with you. Again, that's probably why a lot of people float their ground. I know people who are very clever and have been in this hobby for 50 years, and they've been floating their ground for most of that time, and thankfully they don't live in areas where, you know, they're the highest object in a lightning rich environment, so it's not that important. But, you know, you pays your price, you takes your chances. But I agree with you that as you go farther off of the surface ground in your shack, as you get higher and higher, the less useful grounding wires tend to become.
I just wanted to also find out why you were saying that the utility ground, the middle wire of the of a plug, is not a good ground. I mean, that would be an AC ground, I guess. But I'm not sure why you ruled that one out.
Tony B2 Jackson.
Yes, Rich.
AC2 Jackson, the group, WB2 GXM. For one thing, lightning can travel through your electrical system. And it's not unheard of for lightning to back up, as it were, through your electrical system into your radio equipment and damage it that way. So grounding to the utility of your house can damage your radios in that way. I will also add that some very well-known amateurs, such as Bob Heil and various others, do not ground their equipment. They bond everything together, so everything's at the same voltage potential, but they do not ground their stations. WB2 Jackson.
Thank you very much, Rich, and welcome back to the Technical Net. And also, there is a tendency for current to leak in the electrical ground. So the ground potential for an electrical circuit is not necessarily equivalent to a good earth ground. It theoretically it's supposed to be. I realize the bond is in the common in the fuse box. But by the time it circles around the house, you're never quite sure. So I do not think it is a good practice for both the reasons that Rich mentioned and just the general tendency for AC current ground not to be exactly perfect, that it is not a good replacement for a good earth ground.
I'm just wondering, this is VIU, whether... if you're building your antenna in the attic where there's no lightning danger, whether you're safer floating your ground than somebody who's building it outside.
I would tend to think so. You're obviously not going to be the tallest structure anyplace. So, you know, unless you have incredibly bad luck, because you know, some people just have that bad luck, that's probably low on your list of risks. That a lightning bolt is going to go eeny, meeny, miny, moe and decide to go through your attic. You know, if that happens to you, I don't know. You're not a lucky person.
Comment?
Yes, comment.
B2RMD. A lightning strike 5-10 miles away can still increase, you know, voltage potential around that footprint. And still, which can still be picked up by antennas. It doesn't have to be a direct.
Well, that's true, but there are other things that you can use. You can have one of those spark gap, safety devices that leech the power. I don't know if if it's going to wreak havoc from that far away. I don't recall anyone really reporting it. I mean, it'll probably wreak havoc initially with the front end of your receiver, but there's only so much EMF that's going to get to you from 5 miles away from another lightning strike.
I've heard from other hams that, you know, it doesn't have to be a direct strike. It could still be a nearby strike, per se. That could still cause trouble. But but it's to a much lesser degree. So I do agree. Back to net.
Okay, very good. Any other comments out there on the subject?
GXM?
Yes, Rich.
Another factor with attic antennas, and by the way, I'm pretty enamored of attic antennas myself. I plan to put up an attic antenna before an outside antenna. An outside antenna tends to accumulate static charge because of wind moving over it, snow, rain, etc., which does not happen with an antenna that is shielded inside an attic.
Well, that's true, Rich. There's a lot of pluses going for attic antennas. It's shielded, so it's going to have much less of the erosive effects of local weather. You know, some people who live, a mile or two away from the ocean, it still doesn't help much. They get salt water spray and fine vapors and causes corrosion of their elements that you're not going to see that much inside an attic, thankfully. So, yeah, there are a lot of features for attic-based antenna design. Okay, any other comments, questions, topics for tonight?
This is WA2VIU again with a different topic. If you're getting tired, we can talk about it a different time.
No, I'm not getting tired. What's your first name, by the way?
Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, WA2VIU. I'm just wondering about my old Yaesu ST-101EE was not functional this field day. Unfortunately, I missed out on field day, so WA2CDL may take a look at it, but if it's not fixable, I'm in the market for a new rig. And, you know, you read some of the ads, and they're so expensive, many thousands of dollars. I think one of the highest ones from ICOM, maybe $12,000. I'm just wondering whether all these are just bells and whistles or whether there's actually high quality that you would use on a day-to-day basis in operating. Is it better rejection from interference, better sound quality, things like that, or is it just cool stuff that you don't really need?
Okay, Barry, that's an excellent question, and hopefully I'll get to hear a lot of other people's opinion. I think to a degree it's the bells and the whistles. I think it's possible you were talking about the top-of-the-line ICOM is probably the most expensive Japanese radio. They had a gold-trimmed model for something like $12,000. There are more expensive ones. Germany, would have to be Germany, I think, sells a amateur radio transceiver that goes for something ridiculous like $16,000. I think it's in terms of diminishing returns. When you go from, say, a $1,000 box to a $2,000 box, you get a lot more improvement than if you go from a $2,000 to a $4,000 or a $4,000 to a $12,000. So you probably should be geared by the specifications because they're usually legitimate. And if you've ever looked at the Sherwood receiver list, they list the specs on a lot of different radios, and it's a very useful feature. There are some favorites out there. It seems like every other guy that I talk to has an ICOM 7300. Those are software-defined radio-based radios, and they are selling at a very good price point. But you go and you find the feature that you really can't live without. Some people like a lot of dials and buttons. Some people like none. I have a Flex radio that has basically about five buttons on it, and most people would kind of hate that because they like a lot of buttons. But I think the overpriced ones are more to show off that you have the money. You know, it's like the old story about the grand piano. that the guy parked outside his house, and someone asked him why the hell he put it there, and he said, well, because no one else would know that I could buy one if I put it in my house.
That's pretty funny. I like that comment. But some of the things about the dual receivers is really how often you need to listen at two bands at once. I mean, usually just focusing on one band at a time seems to be there, and if you want to change bands, you change bands. But when you're listening at two bands at once simultaneously, I don't really recall ever having that need.
Well, again, if you don't need it, then you don't need it. The dual receiving is useful for people who are kind of looking around the band with one ear and keeping an eye on their favorite frequency with another. I mentioned that I have a Flex radio, which is basically a software-defined radio. The interface for it is computer-based, although you could run it on a tablet. And that's capable of 8 simultaneous virtual receivers at the same time. And to me, it's sort of nice. I can go on my 10-meter net that I run every Sunday morning, and I run pan adapters with the entire HF band, and I can see how the activity is doing on 20 and 40 and 80. And, you know, I mean, do I need it? No, I don't need it. But then, do we really need our radios?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I guess if you have a need for it, but I'm wondering also if you found that these software-defined radios in general are better than the old analog radios that we grew up with. Is there any better sound quality or innate advantages? I'm not talking about add-ons that you could do storing your, you know, storing stuff or whatever it is, but I'm just talking about the actual day-to-day operating. Do the software-defined radios work better than the analog radios or not?
Well, like anything, it sort of depends upon how much time, effort, and engineering goes into anything. You can build a legacy radio that can mimic most of the specs of a software-defined radio. One of the things you might have problems doing is to have a clean filter that is adjustable on the fly and that has no ringing whatsoever. You know, most mechanical filters, if you make them sharp enough, will ring. You can build an algorithm on a software-defined radio with an incredibly sharp slope and won't get any ringing. Plus, you can adjust them on the fly. I can adjust the bandwidth of my transmission, the reception bandwidth filter in real time, which some modern radios that use digital signal processing and other things can mimic. But the old-fashioned mechanical filters, you would have to pop the top and swap the filters.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate those thoughts. I'm just curious if you want to mention the brand name of your rig or if that's private information.
No, not at all, Barry. I'm very pleased and proud of my Flex radio. I have a Flex 6700. It came out about 6 years ago, and thankfully it hasn't been upgraded. You know, these things kind of are almost like commodities. You know, you buy it and 2 years later it's out of fashion and they're selling a new shiny model. But Flex Radio is still selling the Flex 6700. And it is overkill for some. I've often had people kind of say, I don't know why you would need 8 receivers. I also have my computer hooked up, so if I actually wanted to record 8 separate radio streams, I can. And I did that as a test once. But there, unfortunately, aren't 8 communications that I need to monitor that closely. Maybe the military does.
That's interesting. Also, you have a good signal here on 2 meters, very clear. My hearing is very poor, and if I can hear you well, that's quite a compliment. So I'm just curious what make and model you're using and how many watts you're putting out right now on 2 meters.
Okay, right now I am using my ICOM IC7100. I used to use my Flex radio. It's configured. It's really designed to be an HF radio, the 6700. It has some moderate ability at 2 meters. It requires a high-gain amplifier because it only puts out a couple of milliwatts of transmission power. But I have it set up with also with a transverter, so I can use it to transmit on UHF and VHF. But I find it's just a little bit easier to stream my audio signal on the Internet if I use the ICOM 7100. Usually, I'm only running at 20% power, which is about 10 watts, but because there were problems hearing me earlier, I've boosted it up to the full 50-watt output of the ICOM 7100.
Okay, thanks, because it's quite a good thing for me to keep in mind my 7-meter. I just have an old ICOM 2SRA handheld by now, and it's using a 7-volt battery. I'm very old, probably 20 years old. So I think it's only picking out 1.5 right now, but I'm trying to order a new battery, and a 12-volt battery is supposed to put out 5 watts. It's supposed to come this thing from eBay, assuming they send the order process. But at any rate, I can hear you very well, so I appreciate it. I think I'm about to step out now, but I appreciate your thoughts tonight on a number of different issues. Thank you.
Okay, very good, Barry. Thanks for participating. I do like my IC7100. I've had it since about 8 years ago, and they're still selling them. They're not quite as pretty as the latest, greatest model, the monochrome touchpad with a separate head. I put the head on my desk, and the rest is goes on a rack to the side of me, and it works out very nicely. It's a very pleasant all-in-one radio. It does HF, it does VHF, UHF, and for whatever reason you might want to, it's capable of doing D-Star digital as well.
That sounds good. I'm just also curious what kind of an antenna you're using right now on 2 meters as well.
Right now I'm using a Comet GP6. I also have a GP3 hooked up as a backup and to listen to my signal when I'm not desensing everything with way too much output power. So right now it's a Comet GP6. I like the Comet. I understand some people prefer Diamond. They think that Diamond is a little bit higher quality, but I don't know. I really don't see much of a difference personally.
It's YVP. Comet.
Okay, thanks a lot. This is WA2BIU. I'm going to get off now, but I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Barry. Please come back and participate in the future. Matt, you wanted to say something.
Roger, I have a question. I didn't know you wanted a 7100. Well, you're listening to me on a 7100. I love this radio. I got it 2 years ago. In my shack, I have one of these folding tables that's 6 feet long. That's what I use for my desk. So to make room, I actually put the rig on a table. It's in the corner. It's not far from the window. I always get fine with the window, but nothing's going to come. So I cover it with I use a pillowcases to cover the main unit, and I cover the remote head. So I got this, and then what I did is I had taken it, it was used as my base station before I got the radio when I was 50, but I put it back into the shack as my dad into a PLF. I have my dad's ICOM 2410. I took an AV switch, I hooked it up to the UHF side, push over to, and then what I could do is I could switch it. Well, it's confusing. I switch it to B for this, and I have to switch my desk mic. I have an SM8 desk mic. I have two of them, my dad's and mine. I've had this microphone for nearly 30 years, and it works great. It's an awesome microphone. You know, it's a nice desktop mic, and it works with all the ICOM radios. So I know, so I hear you all the time. So the radio sounds great. I set this up for FT8. I did all the settings. I'm just trying to figure out how to do the software now on the computer, and I'll eventually get it, figure it out. Back to you.
MBB with a comment.
Yes, Bob.
Yes, I also love my ICOM 7100, which you, Roy, recommended to me 2 years ago when I got it. And unique feature, of course, the small head. I have a cramped space area. Any other radio, I couldn't put in a convenient place to reach the controls. But this one, the little head fits on my little computer desk right behind my trackpad and my computer keyboard. Works great. Also, I ordered the extra long 16-foot connecting cable between the head unit and the main radio, and I pulled into the other room of my small apartment, which is my bedroom, and it can reach in there, and I can operate from there as well. And I don't think there's any other radio on the market I can do that with. So for my situation, it's great. But I have a question, because right now, for the first time, I've noticed this. When I leave my mic plugged in, I'm just listening. There's some drop-offs in general, but when the mic's plugged in, I get this click in the in my radio. So I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. Back to you, Roy.
No, I'm not quite sure what that was. If anyone wants to kind of see my IC7100 in action, if you go to my QRZ page, I actually took a picture of the way my my shack looks like when I do these technical nets with my computer showing all kinds of multiple windows open of all kinds of strange activity going on. And just in the corner is in blue and black is my ICOM 7100. So you can check that out if you have some time. Okay, let's try out a little puzzle tonight. We haven't done a puzzle in a while, and people seem to be a little on the active side, thankfully. I appreciate it. So let me ask you this little question and see if I can elicit a reaction from a few people out there. So, and there's one person who definitely knows the answer to this because he was discussing it on the repeater. Someone sells you some really inexpensive cloned LMR 400. It doesn't have any label on it, doesn't have any name on it, but he swears by the stuff. So you take a look at this, and you see what usually you see with an LMR 400. There is a polyethylene UV protected jacket on the outside. Then there is a tin copper braid under that. Then there's tin foil under that. Then there's a closed cell polyethylene foam dielectric insulator under that. And then you got the center wire. You take the center wire, and for some odd reason it doesn't quite look right to you, and you take a little knife and you scrape at the edges, and you scrape away the copper, and you got this silver wire instead of copper wire. So anyone out there, do you think you've been conned by someone? Do you think they gave you some cheap garbage, or do you still think you have an LMR clone?
K2NVP.
Yes, Bob.
I'm just guessing, but the memory's kind of vague when I was reading about this stuff. Might have been for one of the license exams. I think silver a better conductor than copper? Maybe I might just have this bass backwards. It might be a lot worse. So I was going to take, I'll maybe guess it's better, but I could very well be wrong. Back to you, Roy.
KC2FYJ comment.
KD2FYU.
Okay, one at a time. Well, silver, it does conduct better than copper. But if that guy had a silver core wire, he probably should melt it down and sell the silver. Harry, I know George knows the answer to this, but Harry, you wanted to say something.
Well, first of all, I would point out that given that we're talking RF, the energy is going to be out in that copper skin anyway. And that's why they have such wire as copper weld, which is a steel wire covered with copper, the steel for the strength and the copper for the conductivity. My answer would be to take a couple of measurements and check the outer diameter of the inner conductor and the inner diameter of the shield and see if it gives you the right intrinsic ohms And if it does, then you've got good wire. And if it doesn't, you've been ripped off.
Okay, very good, Harry. Yeah, that's a reasonable answer. I do want to just interject a little thing. LMR 100, if anyone's played around with LMR 100, it actually, its center wire is copper-clad steel. So, if you have some LMR 400 in the house, you basically have some copper-clad steel as well. So, George, you want to tell us the answer to the story?